Hello and welcome back to another episode of And the Winner Is. I got it right this time.
Hey.
Joining me as always is Tony.
All right.
Yep, all good. So as always, we are here to talk about a Best Picture winner from the Oscars throughout the years. And this time we are here to talk about the 1952 winner, An American in Paris.
Yep.
So
I've lost my notes, but I'm probably going to sleep again if I read them.
Yeah, I think we're going to have differing opinions on this as well.
I think so. Yeah.
So it should be interesting. So as always, we'll kick off with some facts. I won't go into the box office because it's another one of those ones that's there isn't one. IMDb are reporting one from January 2020. Obviously, when it got re-released. So we won't be talking about that. But it's got an estimated budget of $2.723 million. For the 1950s, that's still quite a lot of money. But then I think that's... we'll get into it, but I think that's partly because of who was in it, more than anything. So... jumping into our trivia, as we always do. I'm to be fair, the first few on IMDb are quite good. So Vincent Minnelli was the director on this, or is credited as the sole director. He actually wasn't. Half the time he was tied up with his divorce to Judy Garland. Or other directing projects. So Gene Kelly directed it quite a lot of the time. That was to the dismay of the cast and crew. And then we'll get into that in a minute. Oscar Levant, more of a pianist than an actor, which pretty much shows in this because he doesn't have a lot to say throughout most of the film. He was only in the film because he was a friend of George Gershwin, who obviously wrote the song that this film was based on, An American in Paris, which is featured, and we'll have a little bit of facts on that in a minute. And according to Levant, the cast and crew disliked Gene Kelly due to his condescending attitude and snide remarks.
Wow.
And there's a little bit more as well on that. Leslie Caron had suffered from malnutrition during World War II, and was not used to the rigorous schedule of filming a movie. Because she would tire so easily, she was only able to work every other day, to the annoyance of Gene Kelly. which is interesting, because Gene Kelly discovered Leslie Caron while vacationing in Paris, where he saw her perform in a ballet.
Wow.
So it was his hire, but he didn't like her. which is unreal. Leslie Caron didn't speak English, despite having an American mother. She wasn't conversant in the language. Luckily, she didn't have that much to say, and it was mostly comprised of dancing. Though I kind of disagree with that, because she does have quite a lot of lines in this film. I find that a little bit of a strange comment to make, because I think she did speak quite a bit, and I wouldn't have known she couldn't speak English. That's very strange. Again, Gene Kelly got annoyed. He wanted to film it in Paris. MGM actually built 44 sets in California. And they did take they did two shots in Paris. Gene Kelly was in neither of them.
In fact, one of the notes I can remember writing down is I wondered where it was actually shot and set, because they were very sort of very set looking streets, I thought.
Yeah, definitely. And that was very much the thing at that point. We all know that Cherry Tree Lane wasn't in England. It was on a set on the Disney lot. My Fair Lady, clearly not in London.
How Green Is My Valley, of course, we discussed that.
Exactly. So the ballet sequence at the end was almost cut.
should have come.
Because it was...
Oh, I didn't give you a spoiler there.
Because they were behind schedule, but everybody at the studio stood by Arthur Freed, who was the producer, Vincent Minnelli and Gene Kelly, in withholding the release of the movie because he felt the movie would fail without it. They said they Arthur Freed originally just wanted to buy the rights to the George Gershwin number American in Paris, but Ira Gershwin said he'd only sell on the condition that if a musical were to use the song, it would only use Gershwin numbers as its other songs. Mm. And then on that note, and I will finish off because I'm just trying to find it. Where's it gone? Because there was a note about how much was paid and what happened with it. I now can't find that. That's really annoying. It looks like it's disappeared. Although, there we go. After Arthur Freed and Ira Gershwin reached an agreement during their weekly pool game, film rights to George Gershwin's An American in Paris, a tone poem for orchestra, was purchased for $158,750, and Ira received $56,250 as a consultant to write any necessary new lyrics.
Mm. I bet it's quite a chunk of money back then as well.
Yeah, very much so. And just sticking with that one, on a final one, the 18-minute ballet has its own credit in the movie's opening titles and presenting the American in Paris ballet.
Mm.
So,
18 minutes. That explains a lot.
So let's dive in. Tony's given you a little preface on his feelings. I got a little spoiler this morning due to a little fact. What was your fact, Tony? Tell the listeners what you found out this morning.
Yeah, so just because I log all my films on something called Letterboxd, and you can go in and you can see different facts about people that are involved in the films. And it turns out that both this and our next record for Grand Hotel, they shared the same art director, a chap called Cedric Gibbons. And I think this is probably the first time in all time we've done this, the two films have had something in common in terms of the cast or crew.
Yeah.
The same month.
Yeah, very, very interesting.
And they're like 20 years apart, aren't they? So
yeah. Gonna be, yeah, exactly. Because obviously the first one is a much earlier film. right at the beginning.
Saw my two scores for the month. So
yeah, I did. So let's dive in. Obviously, as I say, this is 1950s, which I think they always look. There's something about 1950s movies that look different to a lot of others, and
the color palette for one. Yeah,
it was a real progression. I feel that they made in the 50s with how these films looked.
Yeah, if you see a. I mean, because there were, I mean, we all know that there are colour films from the 30s and 40s, Gone with the Wind. And I was thinking that the 50s, that the colour became less kind of shocking.
Yeah.
And more real, if that makes sense.
Yeah, there was a warmth to it.
Yeah, yeah.
Where
if you watch, like the 30s one, it's like somebody took the control button on the TV and just whipped it right up for some of the color scheme.
Yeah,
whereas
definitely.
It's a little bit softer. Yeah, a little bit softer and warmer once you get to the 50s.
Yeah, definitely. This was actually another fact that I read, that this opening scene, obviously we meet Leslie Caron's character, Lise, in the opening scene, though we don't know it at that point, because it's a dream sequence that we meet her in. And it was actually, I wrote down Ooh La La in real life, because it felt like it was the magazine that Biff read in Back to the Future. This scene was nearly cut because of that reason, that it was a little bit risque, but they did feel like it shouldn't be cut. But yeah, it was a strange way to start this film, especially tend to feel like musicals are like that.
And to jump almost in straight away, like a half song.
Yeah.
It's not even really a full musical song number, is it? It's just, what was that then?
No, and it's really interesting because it also then dives into two voiceovers by two different people, which is very different to any, you normally there's a lot of films that open with that voiceover kind of setting the scene.
Not to get one from the three main male characters all in the same sequence is unusual.
Yeah, it's very strange. Talking of one of those, we have to talk about Gene Kelly, because obviously he is, if you think about musicals, it's either, in this era, it's either him or Fred Astaire.
Fred probably retired at that point, wasn't he?
Yeah. And so much so that when we were talking about it, my wife was convinced that Fred Astaire was in Singing in the Rain. And I was like, no, that was Gene Kelly. They were so intertwined, despite the fact that they were very different. And we'll talk about that. Because I feel like Gene probably was...
They're like 20 years apart, effectively, at the height of their career.
And they did cross over towards the end of Fred's career.
No, they're in a horror film, aren't they? They're in a ghost story, I think.
Yeah, it very obviously... Gene obviously took a lot from Fred Astaire.
I need to watch that.
but in some ways, I feel like Gene was the better and more experienced actor in the end. When you look at their IMDb credits, Fred Astaire wasn't in that much.
And
he was more known for his kind of entertainment value than he was his film career.
And probably, arguably, less narrative to them, maybe.
Yeah.
They're very much a bit like the sort of, going back to the artist, very much, here's our couple of people dancing for 2 hours, effectively. And it's sort of, I think things like Top Hat and stuff like that, probably off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But with Kelly's, and some I'll touch on in a bit, there's a little bit more of a narrative, I think, probably to some of his stuff.
Yeah, and I think it does partly come from his dancing background, but he's a very expressive actor.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on with him when you watch him closely, like we do with these films, when we're intent and we're focused in on it. There's something very expressive about him. And then it kind of does dive in. We get a musical number without Gene Kelly, though, which is very interesting to kick the film off as a proper musical. He's not in the opening number.
No.
Which is very strange. But it doesn't take long. And I think, and I know you'll dive into your feelings, I actually think the songs in this are all fairly well known.
Ah, now interesting, because that's one of the things I noted about, and one of my issues is, to me, that there's only really a couple of memorable songs in there, which is I've Got Rhythm.
Yeah.
And It's Marvelous. And really, for me, the rest of the songs, including the main one, are kind of forgettable.
Yeah, yeah, no, and I agree with that. But as you say, I find those two really memorable. Obviously, I think they've got into pop culture psyche. Yeah, they're ones that I've known, even though I've never seen this film before.
Oh, likewise.
But then we get that proper opening number with the three of them again. The three male leads, which I think is great, and it's a real earworm as well.
Yeah.
And bouncing off of each other in that opening scene. And for what's to come in the film later on.
Yeah.
You don't see it coming from this opening when they're all kind of friends at the beginning.
Yeah.
And you don't see what's coming. And I still didn't until it actually happened.
Yeah. And it's a song about music, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Interestingly as well.
Yeah, and as we say, the pianist, it doesn't have a lot to do.
No.
Except for the really weird dream sequence that he has later on.
Yes.
which has absolutely no place in the film at all.
No.
But yeah, he and it's kind of these ones where he's singing with the others or playing with the others that that he really works. And we do get, obviously, Gene at this point dancing. And that's the other thing between him and his name's now gone. Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire. There we go. Even though we've just talked about him. Gene's a much more lucid dancer.
Mm.
There doesn't seem to be the kind of the trained dancer in him. There's something much looser about him that makes you feel like someone else could do it. Like I could do that, what he does. There's some, it's not your typical like ballet or ballroom or anything like that. There's something much looser to his movement than the likes of Fred Astaire, which I quite like. And he does have a real presence on screen, yeah. Which is very interesting for someone that obviously has got that background. Obviously, there's a few others that came through at the time that weren't trained. The likes of Dick Van Dyke obviously came through not long after this, but was always, again, more well-known like Fred Astaire for the entertainment side and one or two roles. Yeah. So Gene was definitely...
It's interesting that, I think I was just looking up to him at the same time, that because this was one of those bizarrely like Grand Hotel, which we'll talk about next time, where there's not much in the way of an acting nomination.
Yeah.
None of the actors got nominated.
Yeah. And that, I think that's the difference when you get these musical films.
Mm.
They don't tend to... Who, Ariana DeBose, I think, got one, did she, for...
West Side Story, she got
yeah.
One,
yeah. And then looking back, Catherine Zeta-Jones for Chicago, yeah. I think. They're very few and far between when it comes to these, because I think it's more the spectacle of the film than it is kind of what goes into it, than anything that catches the eye. And I did say there's definitely that early Oscar winner type feel to this movie, especially early on.
Yeah.
Once he meets the older woman.
Yeah.
Yes. There's definitely a class feel to it that we've seen throughout these early films.
Yeah, yeah, because she could be quite offhandish, couldn't she? Because she's sort of a bit of an art critic, isn't she?
And yeah.
Fan and
yeah, and kind of makes him feel kind of inferior, certainly yeah, to start yeah. with. And let's dive into that, because it's a very strange relationship. Obviously, she's rather flirty to begin with.
Mm.
And obviously, they agree to go out. And then he goes off after Lise. And you can clearly see that something going on behind her eyes at this point. Yeah. That that's not what she was after. She was after something more. Yeah. And she has that complete meltdown about it on the way home. But then the next morning, it's like nothing happened.
Yes.
It's incredibly weird.
Yeah.
And it's yeah. that timing thing again, isn't it, that we've talked about throughout these early films, that things seem to move really quickly at some points and at other points don't move quick enough.
Mm.
But there's definitely an improvement.
Yeah,
in these films,
weird sort of. I'll go back to relationship for a minute. She sort of, there's almost this sort of Mrs. Robinson sort of feel to her, and the Jean's character is kind of her next project. And there's a couple of lines of dialogue from one of her associates to sort of suggest that's what she kind of does.
Yeah,
proteges, didn't she? And sort of
yeah. And then there's that definite feel with the people that they're with in the club. Or the bar, that seem to insinuate that they think it's a little bit weird that he's gone off to speak to somebody else.
Yeah, and left her to it, yeah.
Yeah, a very weird relationship. And it gets weirder later on as well.
Because he's effectively her date, and he's sat there looking at checking out another woman when he's sat.
Yeah, and even dancing with her and then giving getting her number.
I did write that and I think it's probably one of the problems I had with the film, seeing in the first half. His character is a bit of a dick, actually.
Yeah. There he is. He's clearly got a chip on his shoulder.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
That he's been forced to go somewhere that he's not really looked well upon.
Mm.
And is a bit stuck. I found it really weird that she throws that Fett in the car, and then the next morning, eating out of his hand again. I have to say at this point as well, Leslie Caron and Gene Kelly, they make a beautiful pair on screen. There really is something, and there seems to be a real connection between the two of them. And obviously, we talked about the fact that he discovered her, yet there was some friction between them.
Yeah.
And that shows on screen as well, certainly in the opening parts when she wants nothing to do with him. Because she does. And again, it's another relationship that changes really quickly.
Yeah.
Because she kind of doesn't want anything to do with him. Her phone number gets passed on kind of accidentally.
Yeah.
But then when they speak the next time, she's quickly agreeable to going on a date with him.
Yeah. Even though she's seen somebody else.
Yeah. Well. And has been for a long time by the sound of it.
Yeah.
So very strange. And then I think for me, that's when we get the real set piece of this film. Is that first scene along the river between the two of them.
Yeah.
One of my favourite musical pieces on screen, I think. It just works so well. And obviously it is a set, as we've discussed. It's definitely not in Paris. it looks like any set in that era. You can tell there's no hiding it. These days you can hide it when it's a set, but those days you couldn't. But I think the pair of them work so well together. Obviously, she's clearly a well-trained ballet dancer, whereas he's clearly not, and it kind of bounces off each other for me, which I just really love. And obviously, probably her biggest scene. She does have a bit to do in the ballet scene at the end, but it's not all about her, obviously, as we know. But I just think it works really well between the pair of them.
That's interesting, because that was one of the little notes that I did make, is that I didn't feel overly invested in them as a couple in this one.
Yeah, I can understand why.
Some discussing it on some of the other films we've looked at. I said they look and work well together, but I kind of didn't care about it.
And I get that, and I think that's because it's not just about that relationship.
Yeah, it's because there's those other couple of ones just floating around the edge of it, and I think it's sort of which one of them should I be most interested in, you know? And it's
And as we said, the pianist is kind of gets in the way at times.
Yeah,
and slows things down. Really,
we mentioned that really weird dream sequence where it's like he's all the people in the orchestra and stuff, and it's just so bizarre. And I just what is the point of this? You could knock 10 minutes off the film if you took this out.
Yeah.
It serves no purpose to the film.
Yeah, and I said, my note was, oh, this is weird, him doing everything in the orchestra. I'm very out of the blue, because he's been nothing but support cast.
Yeah.
So far. And he gets one other scene, doesn't he? Where he pretty much tells the art lady that he knew who she was.
All along, yeah.
Very, very strange. The only thing I will bring up with that scene is it is a very early example of split screen.
Mm, yeah.
Which like I thought was
him in one of the shots.
Yeah. Yep. And you also get the side by side shot of him kind of not conversing with himself, but there's a kind of an exchange between the two versions of him, which for 1950s I thought was really good. But I did say at this point, and I kind of agree with you on what you've just said about the relationship, there does seem to be kind of a big chunk of their relationship missing.
Yeah.
Because it moves on very quickly that they're kind of in love but having to kind of move apart. It feels like they've built something up that we've not seen. I do very much agree with that, that the relationship isn't the strongest part of this film. That's for sure.
Yeah.
But it's, again, we get another moment with the three male leads. Obviously, before we find out what's going on, that it's him that's, or around the same time that we find out that it's him that she's with, and has dumped Jerry for. But the three of them in the, I can't work out whether it's a coffee shop or it's a bar or it's something along those lines. I think it's a coffee shop because they always ask for coffee, don't they?
Yeah.
When there's something going on. So, but we get another one of those scenes like we did at the beginning of the film with the three of them, that works really well. But then, as we said, it is amazing what gets into the public psyche. We have those two films, that the two songs that you mentioned. It's marvelous. It's wonderful. I knew that from when I was a kid.
Yeah. They always see them on variety shows and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. And then I said, I really hope it all works out, because at that point, it just felt like everything was crashing and burning for everybody. Once we get to the kind of the black and white party, don't we?
Yeah.
Everything's just gone to hell for everybody. And they all know it as well.
Mm.
At that point, you can tell there's some dawning from certain people that there's something not right here. So it just doesn't go well. But as you pointed out, maybe we're not as invested in the one relationship, but I am kind of invested in the, can't even say it's a triangle, can you really? It's a square. Because it's all moving pieces.
Yeah.
I was quite invested in that as a whole.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rather than the individual ones.
Yeah.
Especially that end bit. And despite what we've said about the fact that the ballet is 18 minutes long, there's some exquisite choreography in it.
Oh yeah, it looks fantastic. This is well put together. Some great color schemes and stuff in it, and great shot. But I'm watching it and I'm thinking, oh, this kind of reminds me a little bit of it, and I wonder whether that's where they got it from, the end of La La Land. And I'm just, so this is basically just one of those, this is the life they could have had sequences.
Yeah.
But of course, with the differences that they do end up together at the end of this. But I'm thinking, why is this going on so long?
Yeah.
And I don't really care.
Yeah, no, and I totally get that. Yet I was still mesmerized by it.
Yeah. I suspect it probably may work better on the stage version, actually, in some ways. You would be drawn completely to it on stage.
And I will say this, once I finished it, because I only finished it this morning while we're recording this, I started watching it yesterday and just had to finish the last like hour this morning.
Yeah.
The first thing I did was looking up whether it was on the stage anywhere.
It is on, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's very, very interesting. Tour. Yeah, it might possibly be.
I'm sure I see some local dates somewhere.
So. Yeah. And it is kind of an amazing set piece to finish the film off.
Mm.
both kind of outside of the ballet sequence, but the party sequence leading into it as well.
Yeah.
It's even if it's not your kind of thing, which I can't say I'm a ballet fan.
No.
But it's so vibrant.
Mm. Yeah.
Across those two scenes. That it does keep you engaged, even if you feel like, as you say, Tony, that it doesn't belong. Mm. And overall, it does end on a happy note, which is a strange one for an Oscar winner.
Yeah, because especially the way that is all set up, like I said, like the end of La La Land in later years, where they don't get together and we just see what they might have had together.
Yeah.
This is the same thing, but then it tells at the end, well, they are possibly going to have all of this anyway.
Yeah. So before we jump into final thoughts, what else do you want to throw at the listener with your thoughts?
I say that for me, the reels were kind of the star of the show, of what it's really more about is Paris.
Yeah.
To me, that's the effective the star of the film, even though it's a backlot.
it's
very much, and I kind of want to see a bit more of that. I like the stuff with the kids and everything.
Yeah.
And the I Got Rhythm song that he sings with the kids, and
and that kind of has a touch of the Sound of Music to it.
Yeah. Yeah, where he gets him to sort of start playing a little bit I Got and all that stuff. Yeah, and it's all. But it's just, yeah, it was one of those films for me where I wanted to like it more than I did. I'm watching it thinking, you know, I think Gene did much more interesting films for me in the musical genre that are much more my way. I think Singing in the Rain, Brigadoon, which I think are both cracking films. Stuff like On the Town as well. Which I think is the one where he dances with Jerry Maggs, isn't it?
Yeah.
For me, are far higher up in ranking of the stuff that he did in the musical genre. This one sits for me quite low down. I didn't really care enough about the story at the end. It just doesn't seem to really go very far for me. I can see what the aim of the story is, you know, that sort of that division that's created by the by his art contact and all that stuff. But I just didn't really ultimately care enough, and it actually became a bit of a slog in the end to get to the end of the film. And then we had that, like I say, it is a very sumptuous ballet sequence. But for me, it just, okay, why are we getting this now at the end of this film? It's just, please finish the film.
And I'm at the other end of the scale, and I tried to be constructive with my thoughts and not just go, oh, it's brilliant.
Mm.
I did try and break it down and kind of get those bits that I knew where you were coming from.
Yeah.
But for me, I think it's a really beautiful piece of cinema.
Mm.
He's an old school leading man.
Yeah.
Handsome and can pretty much do everything.
Yeah.
And he does in this film. I feel he really shows some of his range in this. The music, as I said, a couple of songs that are incredibly memorable through time as well, not just because of the film. They've kind of gone above the film.
Yeah.
In some ways. And a happy ending, as I say, is a very unusual thing for an Oscar winner. Should we do our scores?
Yeah.
On the doors.
So for me, this is probably going to rank. It's probably one of the lowest scores I've given in this. I would probably put this around maybe a 68, 69-ish, 70. Well, we'll split the difference. We'll go 69. You were.
Oh, yeah. I'm the other end of the scale. I'm going to give it a 91.
Wow. Like,
I thoroughly enjoyed it. And as I say, if I get the chance, I would love to see it on stage and see how it compares, because this is very visually pleasing on screen. So I'd be very interested to see how it translates onto the stage. So, yeah, I knew it was going to be very different between the two of us.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because I'm also, as I said a minute ago, I'm marking it up against some of his other projects, stuff for me, which has got, I always think, as we said, that we discussed before, I always think about the rewatch value.
Yeah.
And this isn't one I particularly rush back to watch again, where the stuff like Brigadoon, like Singing in the Rain, I can watch those over and over.
Yeah. Yeah, and Singing in the Rain is in my top 10 films ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, this wasn't quite that good. But, yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And yeah, I wish I'd been able to sit through the whole thing, but I got disturbed yesterday and couldn't finish it. So I watched it first thing this morning. So, yeah, that wraps up our thoughts on An American in Paris, the 1952 winner. So we will be back with another episode, which Tony will be hosting, which is our thoughts on, I've written it down, Grand Hotel. I'd forgotten I'd watched what I'd watched. That shows which I watched today. So I don't know why I've forgotten that. But yeah, join us for the next episode when we will be talking the Grand Hotel.